The 38th study of the Apocalypse, held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 10th of May 1977. Brother John Knowles, speaking to the subject, The Vintage of the Earth and the Harvest of the Earth, and the reading, Revelation chapter 14.
Brothers and sisters and friends, we will commence our study class this evening by the singing of hymn 140. Hymn 140. We do extend a very warm welcome to our interstate visitors that are with us this evening and those that may be with us from our local ecclesias. We hope that you will have a pleasant and an interesting evening with us. And to commence our evening this evening, we will ask our brother Jeff Lohman to read for us Revelation chapter 14.
Reading together, Revelation chapter 14. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters, and as the voice of a great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps, and they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne, and before the four beasts and the elders. And no man could learn that song but the 144,000 that were redeemed from the earth. These are they which were not defiled with women, for they are virgins, These are they which follow the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were redeemed from among men, being the firstfruits unto God and to the Lamb. And in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come. And worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters. And there followed another angel, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead, or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up for ever and ever, and they have no rest, day nor night, who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, Write, Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours and their works to follow them. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, having on his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, Thrust in thy sickle, and reap, for the time is come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was ripped. And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, he also having a sharp sickle. And another angel came out from the altar which had power over fire, and cried with a loud cry to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, Thrust in thy sharp sickle, and gather the clusters of the vine of the earth, for her grapes are fully ripe. And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth, and gathered the vine of the earth, and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horse bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs.
Brother Jeff, for that reading, we now ask our brother John Knowles to lead us in the study, and the title for our study this evening, The Vintage of the Earth and the Harvest of the Earth.
Brother Chairman and dear class members, the title as announced naturally takes our attention to the latter part of Revelation chapter 14, and God willing this evening we are going to conclude this particular section of our study of the Apocalypse. So by way of a quick review again, let's have a look at our overall structure to see where we are now as far as our current studies are concerned. And we recall that we're looking at this general section which goes from chapter 7 verse 9 through to chapter 15 verse 4. These divisions of course have been indicated by those key expressions such as after this I saw, or after these things I looked, or other such similar expressions. This particular section, shown on the transparency in black lettering, is the section which deals with the three main visions: the seven trumpets, which are God's judgments on Catholic Rome, the vision of the of the two witnesses, the contemporary developments in Western Europe, and now the section that we're looking at, which really started in chapters 12 and 13, which were the contemporary developments in Christendom, with chapter 14 and the first four verses of chapter 15 being the culminating judgments on that section. So God willing, this evening I hope to be able to get down to chapter 15, verse 4. We'll endeavour to get that far, but if we don't, we'll wait and see what happens when our time runs out. But that will therefore bring us to the conclusion of that section, and in fact to the conclusion of this particular set of notes that we're working to at the moment. Well, as far as chapter 14 is concerned, just go quickly through the verses which we've looked at up to this stage. The first five verses dealt with this picture of the Lord Jesus Christ surrounded by the saints as they are seen in their immortalized glory. It was a very beautiful picture in those opening verses, particularly the theme of the harpers, as we saw there in verse 2. And we're told the basis upon which they are accepted into this divine community, and that basis is that these are they, verse 4, who'd followed the Lamb whithersoever he goeth. These were they who were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb. And those of you who've been following this study with the aid of Eureka will know that Brother Thomas says quite a bit about the aspect of first fruits being found in the opening verses of this chapter. I haven't dealt with it very much at all, and if you haven't been following it through Eureka, well, I would strongly recommend that you do, and that you read what he has to say about these opening verses being the anti-type of first fruits. We're going to say a little bit more about it later on tonight, because we're going to have a look also at the feast of Passover, which is referred to later on in the chapter. So here then is the anti-type of first fruits. And these people here are accounted worthy of being in this community on the basis of the fact that they followed the Lamb whithersoever he goeth, and in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. We then see the work that they are to perform in the pouring out of three successive sets of judgment. In verses 6 and 7, we have what is known as the mid-heaven proclamation, and this is essentially a merciful proclamation. So here are the saints now enthroned in Zion. The battle of Armageddon has taken place, and the rule of Jesus Christ is now to be extended throughout all the earth. The first work, then, is to offer a proclamation and an invitation of mercy to the nations to submit. This is expressed in the terms of verses 6 and 7. Let's look at verse 7. The angel cries with a loud voice, saying, "Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters." We considered, didn't we, that some nations will accept this merciful proclamation. Essentially, the British power will accept this merciful proclamation. They will therefore assist in the regathering of the remainder of the Jewish people back to their land. It's obvious, though, that some nations don't accept this merciful proclamation. And therefore, in verse 8, we have the second angel. Although it's the same group of people, it consists of the saints performing this work, it's now the second stage of the extension of Christ's rule throughout the earth. And this consists of the destruction of Babylon. The city of Rome itself is destroyed. And this is meant to be a token warning to all of those throughout the world, and particularly throughout Europe, who would worship this system. And so the work of the second angel is the destruction of the city of Rome itself. But it appears that there are still many who don't accept this warning. And so verses 9 to 11 is the work of the third angel, and this was the section where we concluded last time. We started to hurry through the latter part of that, so we will take up our theme from the latter section of the work of this third angel. The work of the third angel, therefore, consists of the pouring out of God's judgments on those who worship the beast. Verse 9, the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If any man worship the beast and his image, and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation." So this, as we saw last time, consists essentially of the Catholic powers of Europe. And the way in which God's judgments will be poured out upon those will be as a result of the work of Elijah, in which the remaining tribes of Israel, the 10 tribes, styled Ephraim in the scriptures, as they are gathered out of the nations, they fight their way back to the land. The rebels are purged out from Israel, and God's judgments are poured out upon those nations who resist the movement of Israel back to the land. So whilst there are those nations under the proclamation of the first angel who accept God's invitation to give his people free passage and to submit to his rule, there are those who will resist this, and therefore they are to be judged in the terms of verses 9 to 11. Now, we looked at that in quite some detail, but we didn't look very closely at the symbols which are found particularly in verses 10 and 11. Now, in verse 10, we are told that he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Now, this tormenting, of course, is taken up by the churches, and it's used to speak about hellfire torments and all sorts of silly things like that. But, of course, it's not talking about that at all. It's talking about a fire and brimstone type of judgment, which is going to be poured out as a result of the work of the holy angels and the Lamb. Now, who are the holy angels of this verse? Every time we read the word angels, we don't have to associate it with the messengers who were associated, say, with the work of creation, or who are associated with the present events in God's oversight of the nations. But the holy angels here consist of those angels pouring out the judgments of these particular verses. Consequently, it's another symbol of the saints. And so the judgment of those who worship the beast is to be poured out in the presence of the saints. The saints, of course, of the Lamb. And then we're told in verse 11 that the smoke of their torment ascendeth up for ever and ever, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. So the doctrine of the churches, which speaks about eternal torments, finds quite some support, as they think, in a verse like this, that the smoke of their torment ascendeth up for ever and ever. Well, how do we understand this verse? In what sense can we say then that the judgments will be poured out forever and ever upon these people? If we go back to the book of Jude, we've got a similar sort of description which was used in respect to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, which were destroyed literally by fire and brimstone. In Jude verse 7, we read there concerning the powers of Sodom and Gomorrah, even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. So they suffered the vengeance of eternal fire. Now, is the fire that burnt Sodom and Gomorrah still burning? This is the question. Rotherham gives a very literal translation of that verse. He translates it, as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, having in like manner to these given themselves over to fornication and gone away after other kind of flesh, lie exposed as an example of age-abiding fire undergoing. Well, that's a very literal translation, age-abiding fire undergoing. What it's speaking about here, of course, is an eternal judgment, a judgment which will last for eternity. And in that sense, the symbol of fire represents the judgment. And in the sense, therefore, that the nations were to receive eternal judgment, eternal condemnation, the symbol he uses here is of eternal fire. Now, it's somewhat similar to what we've got here in Revelation 14, although there's a sense, perhaps, in which Revelation 14 is just a little bit different. In Revelation chapter 14 and at verse 11, we've got the judgment upon those who worship the beast described as the smoke of their torment ascending up forever and ever. Now, Brother Thomas says the third angel judgments continue through the millennium. And this is rather interesting, because when we read here that the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever, the phrase forever and ever is in the Greek the aeon of the aeons. That is the age of the ages. And really what it's telling us here is that it is going to be the judgment of the age of the ages. So that whilst the majority of the judgments of God will be consummated in the first 40 years, during which time the people who worship the beast will be judged, the judgment itself is not consummated until the end of the millennium. Because as we know, there will be a revolt at the end of the millennium. Consequently, flesh is not entirely subdued until that has taken place. In which case, therefore, the judgments will continue to be poured out during the period of the age of the ages until the end of that period is reached. And whilst we understand there will be a considerable period of peace between the time of the opening of the temple and the post-millennial revolt, nevertheless it is true in the sense, as Brother Thomas says, that the third angel judgments continue throughout the millennium, principally of course at the beginning and at the end of it. And so, as I said, whilst it can be understood in the same sense as Jude verse 7 that it will be an eternal judgment, it will be a judgment which will be forever, there is even a more literal sense in which we can take it here, that the smoke of their torment ascendeth up unto the aeon of the aeons, which tells us therefore that God's judgments will not be complete until the age of the ages itself is complete. And it concludes by saying, and they have no rest day nor night who worship the beast and his image, and whosoever receiveth the mark of his name. Well, that will do as far as our consideration of the work of these three angels is concerned. But as we mentioned in conclusion last week, the purpose of this chapter and the purpose of the apocalypse as a whole is not to give us a detailed description of how God's judgments are going to take place. It's designed to be a book of encouragement and a book of exhortation. Consequently, we find the theme now swinging back to what is the real message of the book, particularly now in verses 12 and 13. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying unto me, write, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours, and their works do follow them. Now, what do we understand by these verses? The first verse is quite simple. These are terms that we've come across before, the patience of the saints, they that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. But what about this voice which comes from heaven and says, blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth? Now, what do we understand by that? And why does this verse appear in this place? Now, what sort of an answer have you come up with? I don't mean you to tell me, of course, but how do you fit that into the theme that we've been looking at? Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours, and their works do follow them. Those of you who've perhaps had any association with the church systems in previous times, so prior to coming to the truth, will possibly recognise one of the favourite quotes which are used at funerals by ministers of religion. This is an excellent quote as far as they are concerned, because it sort of places a final benediction upon the person who has just died. Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours, and their works do follow them. And of course, having just committed them to heaven, their works go up and speak in favour of them, and their immortal souls will dwell forever in heaven. And this verse is used to comfort people who believe just such things as that. Well, okay, it's obvious that's not right, but what does it mean? Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord. Well, there's no great problem in that expression. Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord. In other words, those who are faithful unto death will, of course, be rewarded. But this expression, from henceforth, is really the key to the expression. Blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth. In your notes you should have Brother Thomas's translation, which helps quite a bit here. You find it on page 153. All of the introductory quotations, of course, are Brother Thomas's translation. If you ever wondered why they're a bit different from the Authorised Version, they are Brother Thomas's translation. Here is the patience of the saints. Hear they who keep the commandments of the deity and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from the heaven saying to me, write, blessed the dead dying in the Lord from this time. From this time. Now, the blessing then is not granted at death, but from henceforth in the kingdom. Now, when it says from this time, what is the time that he's speaking about? Well, he's speaking about the time when these judgments have been consummated. And he's going to go on and show to us that the true blessing, which will come upon those who die in the Lord, because after all, the apocalypse speaks a lot about those who are dying in the Lord, those who are suffering. That's what that previous verse talks about. Here's the patience of the saints. Here are those who are dying in the Lord, waiting for that time when they shall receive their blessing. But their blessing will not come until the period which is styled from henceforth, or from this time. Now, what is that time? Well, it's the time after the judgments of verses 6 to 11. That's what the henceforth refers to. In other words, the saints will not be able to experience the blessings for which they have waited until Rome has been destroyed. That means that the millennium itself will not commence. The kingdom will not be opened until the work of those three angels has been essentially completed. I think probably the note that we've got here on page 153 condenses this about as simply as we might express it. Take that second paragraph. The blessing is pronounced upon those who are faithful unto death, but the blessing itself is not granted at death, but, quote, from henceforth. That is, in the kingdom age, when Rome has been destroyed and the saints can rest from their labours in the millennial Sabbath. And that's an allusion to Hebrews 4 verse 9. So you see, the key phrase there is from henceforth. So the blessing will be pronounced upon those who have died in the Lord, and the blessing will be experienced after the time of the judgments of those previous verses. It doesn't mean from the time that they die, as of course the clergyman would have us to understand, but from the time when those judgments have been complete. Now, that's not the only difficulty in the verse, because it goes on to say, yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours, and their works do follow them. Now, once again, we need to go to Brother Thomas's translation here, and we would encourage the reading of Eureka in particular in this section, because Brother Thomas deals very, very well with this, and it's quite a difficult verse if one tries to interpret it from the Authorised Version. And once again, we've culled the essence of what Brother Thomas says, and if we just look back at our notes again for a moment, we'll pick up the point that he's making. From where we left off, the phrase, their works do follow them, has led many people to believe that the reward to be bestowed upon the righteous will be granted immediately upon death. Such, of course, is not in keeping with the truth, and Brother Thomas's translation is a help in understanding this passage. He translates it, that's the latter part which reads, their works do follow them, he translates that as, their works he goeth in aid of with them. Their works he goeth, or he goes in aid of with them. Well, has that made it easier, or has it made it harder? Well, what does that mean? Their works, he goes in aid of with them. So really it says, yea, saith the Spirit, in order that they may take rest from their labours, and their works he goes in aid of with them. Well, just as we've had to ask what each word means up till now, what are the works that are here being spoken of? If the from henceforth refers to the events which are to take place in the pouring out of the judgments of God, and that it means that the saints will not receive their blessing until that work has been complete, and therefore the kingdom is opened. Not, of course, that they won't have been immortalized. They will have been immortalized. But the blessing that they're looking for, in which they are able to go forth with the Lord and to bring peace and prosperity to the earth, will not be experienced until henceforth from the judgment time. Well, then what are the works that are spoken about here? Well, obviously the works refer to the works that they are going to perform during that particular period. Yea, saith the Spirit, that they may rest from their labours. Now, the resting is not going into the grave. It's not speaking about them dying, but the resting is again speaking about that millennial rest. So the rest that the saints look for, that's that quote in Hebrews 4 verse 9 that we didn't turn up, is the Sabbath in the millennium. So the Spirit then says that they will rest from their labours, the labours being the pouring out of the judgments of those previous verses. That's the labours that are being spoken about. So they will only rest from their labours when their labours are completed. And when it says that their works he goes in aid of with them, it's telling us that when the saints perform this particular work of judging the nations, preparatory to entering into their millennial rest, it will be a work which will be aided by the Spirit, because the Spirit is the subject of that sentence. Yea, saith the Spirit, in order that they may take rest from their labours, and their works he goes in aid of with them. Again, of course, a very, very literal translation. Brother Thomas comments in Eureka that the error in the translation is not for want of a grammatical knowledge of Greek, but because the translators, when they render it correctly, can see no sense in it. Well, I think we'd all have to admit that none of us saw much sense in Brother Thomas's translation the first time we read it, that his works, or their works, he goeth in aid of with them. Well, in this exposition, he says, the reader will see in what sense it is said, their works he goeth in aid of with them. And he will also perceive who it is that goeth in aid with them. The Spirit goeth with them in aid of their works. Without the Spirit they could do nothing, but aided by the Spirit, there is nothing too difficult for them to accomplish. So that the works or labours spoken of in this verse constitute the work of the three angels described in the previous verses. So there is the summary. The works or the labours spoken of in these verses constitute the work of the three angels described in the previous verses. This work will be under the guidance of the Spirit, and it is only when this work is completed that they may enter into the millennial rest. Now, it's not an easy verse to understand, so let's just go back over it again and summarise then, or try and paraphrase what it is saying. Let's go back to verse 12, which is the lead-up. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are they who keep the commandments of the deity and the faith of Jesus. And I heard a voice from the heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead, dying in the Lord. In other words, that's the encouragement for the time when John was writing. That's the encouragement for those who are reading it. The blessing, though, will be pronounced from this time. Yea, saith the Spirit, in order that they may now, I put the word now in just to help the paraphrase, that they may now, that is from this time, take their rest, their millennial rest, from their labours, that is their labours in the pouring out of the judgments of the previous verses. And as far as that work is concerned, then it was a work which was aided by the Spirit, because their works he, that is the Spirit, goes in aid of with them. So really, although there's a little bit of a difficulty in the translation there, when we look at the verse in the context of it, obviously that's what it's talking about. And it's not speaking about some blessing which a person gets after death, but it's speaking about the time when the blessing should be poured out, namely after the judgments have been complete. Bear in mind, I did make the proviso that they will be immortalized, because naturally the Spirit is with them. So whilst they have been personally immortalized, and whilst the Spirit is with them, nevertheless, their hope has not seen its accomplishment until the blessings are pronounced and not just the judgments. I think it's got some difficulties with it, so if there's anything that someone's still not clear on, would like me to go through again, would you just like to ask any questions at this stage? Well, the term the Spirit here is used of the deity himself. The term Spirit is often used in that way, and also in the Apocalypse. I don't think I can put my finger on one just at the moment, but the term the Spirit is not used just so much in the sense of the power in an impersonal sense, but it's used in the sense of the deity as Yahweh, the Spirit. Well, that of course is a paraphrase from Corinthians, isn't it, which is probably a good reference to turn to prove that the word the Spirit can be used of the deity himself. Now that's in Corinthians, I think it's the second of Corinthians, isn't it, chapter, what's the bottom left hand corner anyway, whichever chapter it is, keep talking long enough we'll find it. Yes, the second of Corinthians, that's right, chapter 3, and the last two verses. Now, the Lord is that Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. But we all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same glory, into the same image, from glory to glory, even as by the Lord the Spirit, which reads the Spirit of the Lord, but it's actually the Lord the Spirit. So the term the Spirit then is frequently used in the scriptures to speak of the deity himself as being the source of all spirit and the source of all power, and therefore in that sense in Revelation chapter 14 it is the Spirit in a personal sense. As well, of course, as being the Spirit power of God possessed by the saints. But inasmuch as it is the Spirit speaking, yea, saith the Spirit, it's obviously personal too from that sense. Anything else from that verse? You reckon you could walk outside now and bail someone up going along the street and explain that verse nice and convincingly to them? It's not an easy one, is it? It's all right to listen to someone else explain it, and I've had to practice it a few times, and I don't know that I got it over all that clearly, but of course if somebody's ingrained in the idea that it means something different, well, you'd have a very difficult job, I would think, in convincing them that it means what we've said it means. But really, I think it's quite convincing to a person who understands the truth, because we've taken it in the setting, in the time setting particularly, which is found here in this section. Just beat you by half a second over here, so we'll take this one first and that one second. I sensed the problem as I was saying it, and I just kept going. Yes, there isn't really a problem, but the way I said it seemed to create a problem. I realised that. What I said was that Brother Thomas makes the point, and this is his quote, that the third angel judgments continue through the millennium. Now, that is true in a sense. As far as these verses here are concerned, they speak, though, of the judgment essentially concluding prior to the opening of the millennium. Right, prior to the opening of the millennium. And that third angel judgment is complete in this sense. The millennium is then open for worship. The temple is open for worship. The millennium then commences. And the saints are then rejoicing and resting from their labours. But at the end of the millennium, there is this small revolt, which we, well, I say small, there's a small reference to this revolt. It's only for a small period, which is referred to later on in the Apocalypse, which we shall come to. And in a sense, it is a resurgence or a reappearance of this frame of thinking which was seen here in this opposition of the third angel. It reappears again. It sort of disappears during the period of the millennium. So in the context of these verses, we will say that the work of the third angel is completed prior to the millennium commencing. But there is a sense in which Brother Thomas is correct, in which later on in the Apocalypse, he points out that Gog and Magog, the anti-type of the Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 38, who come from the four corners of the earth, as opposed to the Ezekiel 38 one, which simply comes out of the north, manifest the spirit of these people under this judgment period of the third angel. Consequently, the judgment is not totally complete until all sin is wiped out. And so whilst it is basically wiped out here, prior to the millennium commencing, there is still flesh. And it would be in that sense that Brother Thomas would point out that sin is not entirely eradicated until the final judgment at the end of the millennium. Now, I don't know how you can sort of accept that, but I'm trying to explain why Brother Thomas says it in that sense. If that causes confusion, well, let's just say, no, I agree, the work of the third angel is completed before the millennium commences. I thank you for that word. I think the word intensity is the key word. As Arthur pointed out, that the sin will still be there, and there will be the need for those nations who don't come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, as Zechariah 14 says, to be judged. They won't receive any rain, or if they're like Egypt, they'll get plagues on them. So there is a pouring out of judgment, but the intensity is reduced, and then there is the reappearance. But in the sense in which we've said, now this is essentially Catholic Europe, and these judgments will be poured out as Elijah with the refined third of Judah and the saints and the gathered tribes of Israel march through Europe and back to the land, and we sort of bring that to a climax and say, right, that's the end of it. Well, that is true, but sin is still there, and there is also a truth in the fact that the complete judgment is not finalized until the end of the millennium, whether we the resurgence of it. I won't ask if that satisfies you, but if anyone's got any queries still on that point, well, we can perhaps chat about that one later. Did that cover your point, or was
no.
Yes.
My opinion has always been that they have either won about the Battle of Armageddon, fight in the sanctum of the earth. The more people that are still on the earth, and those that die in the Lord in the millennium, are raised to the second judgment at the end of the millennium. Is that the first people that are still on the earth?
Right, I'll repeat that question because, one, the tape recorders mightn't have heard it, and that New Zealand accent mightn't come out on tape recorders, does it? So if there's anyone in New Zealand listening, they might have worked out who that was. Thanks, Brother McGeorge, for that question, just in case they didn't pick your voice. The question actually states, though, and this is very important, really, it says that couldn't this verse suggest that the blessing is being poured out upon those mortal people who die during the millennium and will experience a resurrection at the end of the millennium, and they will receive their blessing then. Now, it depends where you put your emphasis in reading this. It's not so much blessed are the dead which die in the Lord from henceforth, but it's blessed from henceforth are the dead which die in the Lord. It's the blessing which is going to be from henceforth, not those who die from henceforth. Now, that's a very profound statement, so I'll repeat it again if I can in its same form. It's the blessing which is going to be poured out from henceforth. It is not those who are dying from henceforth. It's just the way that the English happens to have translated this and put it in that order. See, if you read it, blessed are the dead from henceforth, blessed are the dead which die from henceforth, then what you were suggesting would be correct. But if it's blessed are those which are dying in the Lord now, and they shall receive their blessing from this time, then of course it means what Brother Thomas says it means. It's not an easy verse, is it? And of course, that other theory would of course just have no... whilst it would sound plausible in the sense of explaining that sentence, it really wouldn't have any meaning in the context of the verses. It it just really wouldn't apply to the work of the saints. You want to try it out tomorrow morning when you get up, if your husband or wife wasn't at the meeting, say, look, I'm going to explain to you what verse 13 is, and see if you can get it all nice and straight. Well, shall we try it again? The blessing then is going to be pronounced from this time. From what time? From the time of the culmination of those judgments. And what is the blessing? Well, the blessing is that they will enter into their rest. What rest? Well, the millennial rest, because the millennium can now be commenced. And the work that they have performed has now been completed, and it was a work which was aided by the Spirit, because...